All right, back to the book of Ruth tonight, and if you're getting bogged down and bored, good news, we're at the end. Not a very long book, but a very powerful book. We have focused, as we've come through here, on Ruth, as the book bears her name. It is the story of more than Ruth, although she is the focal point. And the things that she said, the decisions that she makes bring her to the place where we are in chapter 4 tonight. Remember back in chapter 1, the thing that she said there that began the whole journey was, "I will go." And we talked about that tremendous decision that she made, leaving homeland and kindred, basically leaving everything that was familiar to her, turning her back on the idolatry of her own nation, the paganism of her own nation, and leaving there without husband, without any kin in the new land, and making a decision that was simply framed by that little phrase, "I will go." In chapter 2, as she has come to a place where she did not return to a place of wealth and abundance, she has to labor under pretty harsh conditions. And in chapter 2, the phrase that we talked about was, "I pray you, let me glean and gather," a willingness to do whatever it took to be whatever she needed to be in this land. And then in chapter 3, we dealt with last week, the statement that she made there was to Boaz, as she has met him. She said, "Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid," an appeal for protection. He has been gracious to her in chapter 2, allowing her to glean in his field. He has, we all know, because we know the book, he has slowly but surely fallen in love with this young lady. And she goes to glean in his fields, and in the time of the great harvest, she is just wearied out, and she sleeps there in the threshing floor. And in an act of kindness, he comes and spreads the garment that he's wearing over the top of her, so that she might be worn. I didn't spend a lot of time with it last week, but sometimes in our American way of thinking, we look at that and perhaps the thought is that of sexual impropriety, and nothing could be further from the truth. You find as she reads through here that Ruth is never afraid. She is in the threshing floor. She's there among the hired hands and the laborers, and I mean probably every classification you can think of in life. She never expresses any fear. So this is not an idea of something that is immoral or ungodly going on. And she trusts wholeheartedly in this man who says, "I'm here to take care of you." And he does indeed do that. Then we can get into chapter 4 tonight. I'm going to read the chapter and just kind of make some comments and application if we might. And hopefully you'll spend some more time studying. This is a book I honestly believe could be studied for years. And there are truths and joys in this book and morals that need to be drawn, as well as foundations that are laid for other parts in the scripture. Verse number 1 of chapter 4, "Then went Boaz up to the gate and set him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by." Now, this is a reference back to the last chapter, and Boaz has expressed a desire to have her as his wife, and she is in that situation. We'll talk about in a few moments where she is under obligation because of having a husband that had been her provider, and she has now returned to the land with his mother, that type thing. She is under provision to have her needs met scripturally by her closest kinsman. And we find that Boaz is of near kin, but he is not the nearest kinsman. There is a means and a way things are conducted here. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But she comes down, verse number 1, "Then Boaz went up to the gate, set him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by." That's right there at the end of chapter 3. He said, "There's a kinsman closer than I." In other words, he carries the responsibility. Briefly, that responsibility was that the children of Israel and their land. It's interesting, we're in an argument about who owns the land of Palestine. And for someone to express that ideology simply conveys absolute ignorance of the scripture. Because if you learn anything, you realize that when God brings them into that land and gives them their dwelling, He divides that land by inheritance among the families. All the families of Israel inherit that land, and they are forbidden to sell it or get rid of it. It becomes their possession. And you're going to see that unfold here, because even so much as when Mahlon and Chilion are gone and their father is gone who had possessed land, they still have a claim to that land when they return to the nation of Israel. They are out of the country. They are in the land of Moab here. And even at that, as she returns to the land, she has a valid claim to that land. It could be parted with. I'll go into it in a minute. How's that? Let's finish reading here. But he turned aside and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit ye down here." And they sat down. And he said unto the kinsmen, "Naomi, that is come out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's." Now, she's been gone for some time, but now she's back. She still owns that land. And I thought to advertise thee. That's where we get our word advertise from, by the way. It's King James Bible word. When somebody tells you King James Bible's too hard to understand, ask them if they know how to go shop. Okay, and if they understand the word advertise, there's nothing in the King James Bible you couldn't understand with a third grade education. I realize that may stretch it in this day and time, but that's where we are nonetheless. And he said unto the kinsmen, "Naomi has come again out of the country of Moab and selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But watch this. If thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it," watch it, "beside thee." In other words, that line, that pedigree, that family authority is still in place. He says to the closer kin, the one who's closer kin than he is, "This land's here. If you want to buy it, they can sell it to you, but it has to remain in the family. If you want it, well, good, buy it. If you don't, then tell me." Why? Because I'm in line as well, he says here. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it beside thee, and I am after thee. And he said, "I will redeem it." Being the good fellow he was, who in the world wouldn't want to get a good parcel of land for a good price? He's in the family. He's got that right. And everything seems really good at this point. But how many of you understand this is a setup? This is a big setup, and he's about to lower the boom, as we would say. Verse number 5, "Then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance." And the kinsman said, watch, "I cannot redeem it for myself." This statement changes drastically his whole desire. His decision process turns around and does a 180. He says, "I'll buy it." And then he said, "I can't buy it. Lest I mar mine own inheritance." We'll talk about that in a moment or two. "Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it." Now, this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. "For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor." This was a testimony in Israel. It's the way they transacted business. You say, well, that's kind of stupid. Well, in our day, we take our wallet out of our back pocket and empty it. Okay. I mean, doesn't that sound silly at face value? It was just the custom of the land. It's a biblical custom. We'll look at it in a moment. But he plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was a testimony in Israel. "Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren, and from the gate of his place ye are witnesses this day." You understand how absurd it is to say that Israel has no claim to the land. They were so meticulous that for thousands of years, they knew who descended and what family owned that parcel. That's more than we've done. You probably couldn't tell me who owned the house or the property you're living on 45 years ago. In this day and age, it was kinsmen. And all the people that were at the gate, in the gate, and the elders said, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come into thine house like Rachel and Leah, which two did build the house of Israel. And do thou worthily in Ephratah and famous, and do thou worthily in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. And let thy house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bare unto Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give thee of this young woman." Now what they're saying there is, boy, we want you to go right to the top of the pile. We want you to be great. We want you to have a name of renown. That's what they're saying here, going back through Jewish history. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And he went in unto her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And the woman said, women said unto Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life and a nourisher of thine old age for thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, which is better to thee than seven sons, hath borne him." And Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became the nurse to it. Excuse me, I'll read it in a minute. I have new glasses and can't see anything. And the woman, her neighbor, gave it a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi," and they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nashon, and Nashon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. Those last two verses. Take this young man who literally, if you understand Jewish law and Jewish practice, didn't have much of a chance at all, and elevates him to the lineage of Jesus Christ. You say, why is that important? Because it's important to you and I as a sinner. For two aspects or two reasons. Number one, to realize how totally unworthy we are of the consideration of God at all. We sometimes develop this attitude, well, I'm better than they, you know. I'm not like that guy. I've heard people say that all my life. You tell them they need to be saved. Well, preacher, you know, I'm not that bad a sinner. Let me help you. God would be wasting his time to show any kindness to any one of us. Okay? We are as meaningful to God's purpose as the ants are at a picnic. Okay? The very thought that we could put our thumb somehow in our lapel and think ourselves worthy of the consideration of the Lord is just ludicrous. Because God, simply put, doesn't need us. We need Him. He loves us. And because He loves us, that creates the need that He has for us. But it's nothing we've earned. The Scripture is very plain in a number of places. Not by works of righteousness which we have done, but according to His mercy, He saved us. Mercy. You know what mercy is? Mercy is not giving what has justly been earned. And today where we are tonight, every one of us deserves to burn in a lake of fire forever. And we got mercy. I've always been a little amazed at people that want to work their way to heaven. Well, you know, I'm not that bad. You deserve to burn. Well, I'm better than he, then you should burn together. There's none of us that have earned or merited the mercy and grace of God. We all have to stand collectively as condemned. And so I'm just helping you tonight. There's some people that are not here. They may come in later. And if they come in later, we'll automatically know they're not worthy of going to heaven. They couldn't get to church on time. But for those of us who are here, there are no angels in this crowd right here. And I remind you, if there were angels, angels are the ones that fell and are being cast into the lake. We're all worthy of His justice and His judgment. But as we come through this here, we see this great transition. The time frame again, let me give it to you for the book of Ruth. We used the book of Judges and just the one verse that was there.
Because Ruth is actually a story told in the times or near the end of the book of Judges. In other words, what's going on in Judges is similar to the time frame, or at least contemporary with the time frame of which we read in Ruth. But the Bible said in Judges 21:25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. We're living in a time very much like that in this day and time. There is no right, there is no wrong, there is no law. The law is simply how it is interpreted by people who want to interpret it and bend it and twist it to fit their own ends. Every man does that which is right in his own eyes. Can I help you with that? That's called self-worship. Self-worship. And so those are the times that are the backdrop for the book of Ruth. It is in that time frame that Elimelech takes his wife Naomi and his sons and goes down into the land of Moab, something they should never have done and would have been forbidden if had they known what the scripture had to say about it. But they went nonetheless. And so as they move down there, it is in that backdrop where every man just does whatever he feels like doing that this book unfolds, and that makes it even more miraculous in that Ruth stands out to be one of the most profoundly spiritual characters of the Old Testament. For no reason at all. For no reason at all. And so as we come through this, we took a look at this, and I want us to look at it in a little bit of a different light, because everything in the Old Testament can be utilized to picture something in the New. And as we close out, I want to tell you the story, certainly, but I want to put it in another type or another setting or another backdrop that may help you appreciate where you and I are tonight. I want us to look at the characters once again. Naomi, you know, Naomi is a picture of the backslidden nation of Israel. Now, obviously, her and her husband, her family, they leave. We talked about it in the very first lesson. They leave Bethlehem, the house of bread, because there's a famine. The irony we talked about, if there's no bread in the house of bread, where do you think you're going to get some bread? If it's gone there, it's gone. And yet they leave there, but they not only leave the house of bread, they leave the place where God had given them an inheritance. They leave the place where God had blessed them with children and a family. They leave the place where they had stability, and they go to the very worst place in the world they could have gone. And that's the land of Moab. It's been my experience over the years of ministry that most of the time when people leave the good things of God, they always end up in the worst place they could possibly be. I have counseled over the years people that for whatever reason walked away or stepped out of the bounds of God or whatever it might be. And I have never yet seen anybody that did not say, I never knew I would go this far. I never realized it would be this way. I never understood. And the truth of the matter is, when you leave the Father's house, the only place you can go is to the far country. And that's where the prodigal son ends up. And this family leaves the things of God. They say, we don't need him as much as we need bread. And in so doing, they commit spiritual suicide. We grieved with Naomi as she comes back home again without husband. Without her two sons, all died in that land. You can come back. I just want you to know that. You can come back. But we get a little bit of a warped idea when we come back. I think sometimes perhaps it's because of the treatment that the father gave to the prodigal when he returns home in Luke chapter 16. But when he comes home, the father says, bring the robe and bring the ring and put shoes on his feet and all of that. And we think, boy, there you go. That should be proof that no matter how far away from the Lord you go, you can always come back. And that's true. But you don't always get the shoes and the ring and the robe. You say, that's not fair. No, getting the ring and the robe and the shoes is not fair. Do you know for the rest of his life, the prodigal son lived on a farm or a ranch that didn't belong to him? None of it. Nothing belonged to him on that ranch. You know who it belonged to? It belonged to his older brother. That's who it belonged to. He divided unto them his inheritance. He gave that young man all he had coming, and he went and wasted it with riotous living, and then came back and was granted access. But he didn't own anything. Every day of his life, he was there under the graciousness of his father and then of his older brother. Every time he put his head on a pillow, it was not his pillow. Every time he rode on a horse or in a cart pulled by, it was none of his. Everything, every meal he had from that point did not belong to him. You say, why are you saying that? Because sometimes we get the idea that I can go as far as I want to go and God will always, boy, I can just, it'll always be the same. And I just want you to know, God will always forgive and He'll always give us better than what we deserve. But you never walk away from the Lord without cutting your own throat. And there are people here tonight, they love the Lord, they're serving the Lord, they're happy in the Lord, but they'd give anything that they could give to go back and change one mistake they made somewhere in the past. They'd like to go one place to fix it so they wouldn't have to live in the shadow of that foolishness for the rest of their life. Young people, understand that. You can go to the far country. And you can go to the far country and do some stupid things and you can still get right with God. But I just want you to know you'll regret it the rest of your life. Now they come home. Come home minus a husband and minus her only two sons. She says, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara. Bitter, sad, broken. I'm coming home. She comes home, and Naomi is a picture of the whole country of Israel at this time. You remember as Moses brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, he instituted laws and principles by which they were to conduct themselves. He gave them a path to follow, a way to live, an area in which they should exist, and they pushed the envelope again and again and again and again. God warned them over and over again, when you come into these lands, be careful about what you see and what you allow yourself to become part of. And yet time and time again, they go after the gold, they go after the silver, they go after the gods, they go after the idols, they go after virtually everything that you would think they would have had enough sense to stay away from. And in so doing, they condemn themselves to an additional 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And eventually everything degrades and comes to the place where they're governed by judges. Can I tell you a little bit about the judges? The judges basically were guys who at the time of calamity, they looked around and they said, you're the best one. You help us. Kind of like our politicians today, I think. We don't care. You know, we don't care whether you got any of you go lead us. We'll follow. We'll do this. Sad to say, they have come to that place because they just decided not to do what God wanted them to do. In that time frame, this makes it even more that grand. Naomi and Elimelech and her children go down there, and the thing you would never in the world have expected. As she comes back home without her husband, without her sons, to a place where she is destitute and has nothing. She can't even figure out a way to eat when she gets back. She brings the gem of the scriptures with her without even knowing it. And so they return home. Naomi is a type of a backslidden nation of Israel. She epitomizes everything that Israel was at this time. Do what you want to do. Go your own way. Think your own thoughts. Have it your way. And if it all falls apart, well, hopefully it won't all fall apart. But that was the life. Ruth chapter 3, or chapter 4, verse number 3 and 4, the Bible said, he said unto the kinsman Naomi, that has come again out of the country of Moab, and selleth a parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's. Do you realize, by coming home, she still didn't come home to wealth. She came home, and yeah, that land was still hers. It had not been farmed in ages. It had not been worked. It had not been kept up. It had not been preserved. It was no longer anything more than a burden. And now she's compelled to sell it because she can't even feed herself. It's interesting. She comes back to the land that she forsook so many years before. And now she has to get her own daughter-in-law to go and get a job to feed them both. Isn't that living high on the hog? Fellow said, I thought I was living high on the hog, and then I realized I was the hog. And sometimes that's where we find ourselves. But she returns home. It doesn't get better. It gets better for Ruth, and that's another story we'll look at in a moment, but not for Naomi. She's living under the grace of those around her, what others are willing to provide for. She's living on memories of what it used to be when I was here before. She's looking around. You understand, if you ever go back from where you came from, maybe you're from here, but if you're not, every once in a while I'll go back and drive through Dayton and Kettering, Ohio, where I was raised, and all the buildings look a lot older. The roads are not as nice as I remember. The houses where I used to live are not nearly as nice as they used to be. Things change over time and they tend to run down. And now she's come back to where her memories were vivid of a wonderful life that they had, where there was an abundance of bread before they hit a little bit of a downturn and panicked. Panicked so much that they would walk away on God. And now she's come back and she's come back destitute. She's come back having suffered great, great loss that can never be requited. And now she's come back to a place that really is very unfamiliar because it's changed. It's different. You know, I find I've heard somebody talk about it this week, not here, but somewhere else. But they talk about, well, you know, I walked away from church years ago, but I came back. And you know what I usually hear people say? It's just not the same as it was. Yeah. That's the truth. You say, well, I don't understand that. Those people are supposed to love me and throw their arms around me and forgive you. And they will. They will do that. But you've missed out on that much of their Christian walk. You haven't been a part of that much of their Christian walk. They have grown in their Christian walk. They're not the same people. You say, well, I understand that's a tragic thing, but you can leave Bethlehem and you can come back to Bethlehem, but it won't be the same Bethlehem. Because time marches on. And the time frame has changed when she returns. In Ruth chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, the scripture says, "Then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field?" Boaz now has gotten the go-ahead from this young lady. He has fallen in love. He has made his commitment. And now he begins to embark upon that. And he is ready to set things up, to put things in motion. And he does so by finding himself there in the gate. It's an unusual thought that causes us to find him there in the gate, but that's where legal matters are transacted. That's where things come to pass. That's where trading is done. That's the governmental system. Used to be in the gates of the city, even as near to us, which would be a large jump from where we are here historically. But you come up to the medieval times, and in the medieval times when the castles were built, you'll find those castles had huge walls. Some of those walls are 15, 20 feet thick at the base. And as you come through there, you'll undoubtedly, if you find one that's reasonably well preserved, you'll find there are places to sit. That's where legal transactions were conducted. That's where business took place. That's where the rulers and the fellows that were in charge got together and discussed policy. That would be kind of where, like our Washington, D.C. It's where the laws were made and researched and considered. And it is returning to this place that Boaz now has some business to conduct. And we find him there in that gate. He has a preconceived notion and a plan. He's sitting there waiting. And when this near kinsman comes by, he said, "Hey, we need to talk." And he gathers around some individuals. There were always witnesses whenever these transactions were discussed. You understand the idea of contracts and signed documents were not always a thing that was as popular or as frequent as it is now. Basically, there were times when people gave their word and they bestowed some object. And as long as they had that object, hence the taking off of the shoe. We would think of that as absurd. And yet, I'll bet you know where your house's documents are, where your bank account statements are. That to them was the shoe. It represented a transaction. And when a fella took his shoe off in a transaction, that other fella kept that shoe. And if anybody ever asked, "Well, how do you know this is yours?" You hold that shoe up. You say, "That's silly." Wouldn't you be silly going to get a piece of paper to prove you own a car? It's just the way they conducted business. And so here they are gathered together, and he proposes to this man because this man obviously is interested in the land. He wants that land. Anybody would like to increase their holdings. I've always realized they're not making any more dirt. You want to be wealthy in life, young people? You may not have a lot of dollars, but get some land. I still believe that. I want to be somewhere where I don't have to listen to my neighbors yell and scream at each other. That's another story. We'll talk about that later on. But here he comes. He said, hey, I know you're interested in buying this land. Let's sit down and discuss this now. Let's get this matter taken care of. And he says, yeah, let's do that, goody. And they began to discuss. And he said, now you know that when you buy that land, there's a little more that goes with it. Because, you see, Elimelech and his sons that were the rightful owners of that land moved to Moab, and basically they're dead. If you're going to buy it, you're going to have to buy it from Naomi, because she's the rightful owner of it. Oh, and by the way, you're going to have to buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, because she was married to one of the heirs of this land. That changes everything. He goes from, I'll buy it, to I can't buy it in about 10 words. And all that was there is the day you purchase it from Naomi, you're going to have to buy it from Ruth the Moabitess. You say, why? Do you understand what the Moabitess or the Moabitess meant in that day and that time? What it signified? What it was to be a Moabite? If we had those scriptures this morning back in the Old Testament, the Moabite was forbidden to the 10th generation from entering into the worship of God. Now, let me help you with that. How long is a generation? 70 years? How long is 10 generations? 700 years. Now, if that doesn't seem like a long time, if you read that, it says, to the 10th generation, even forever. God said, don't you ever allow the Moabites ever to interact with you in commerce. Don't you ever allow them to band together with you in worship. They have exceeded the boundaries and I will have nothing to do with them. We talked about the wickedness when we started this study of the Moabites. It is said by some that child sacrifice was instituted by the Moabites and practiced to the worst state you can imagine. And God said, don't even let them in. 10 generations? No, forever. And now then, Boaz says, you know, you buy that land, but the day you buy it, you're going to have to enter into a financial agreement with a Moabite. And he immediately says, I can't buy it lest I mar mine own inheritance. You understand the severity. And the severity was such that even to be linked in that state would have made him a dubious character in the place where he was. Nobody would want to be around him. It was not enough just to be friendly, but to be friendly with a Moabite was to be, and understand this, I want you to help that. A man is known by the company that he keeps. I know we don't believe those things anymore. But young people, you better be careful who you run around with. Moms and dads, you better be careful who you associate with. You say, you think you're better than everybody. No, I think God's better than all of us. And when he says, don't do that, don't go there, I think that's a pretty good rule. You say, well, why? Well, I'll tell you why. If he said, don't go there, I'm afraid to go there because he knows me better than I know myself. And if he told me not to go there, I'm afraid I'd really get in bad trouble. The very idea, you think you're better than everybody. No, I think I'm just like everybody else. That's my problem. I don't think I'm better than anybody. And when God says, hey, I'm trying to help you here. I'm trying to help you live a clean life. I'm trying to help you to be in a blessing place where I can bless you. And here's the way to do it. Stay away from that crowd. Now, there's nothing prohibitive about that. You say, well, I want to run around with who I want to run around with. You know how many people are in prison tonight doing life sentences because they just wanted to run around with who they wanted to run around with? You know how many guys are in prison that made excuses to their parents or to the authorities that they're not as bad as you say they are? And do you understand how many idiots there are that messed up by not just heeding God's prohibitions? You say, well, you just believe you should. I don't believe in mistreating anybody. I believe that everybody has a chance to earn respect. Okay? So if you've got a life that's been dubious and you've been a mess, then all right, change it. Change it. You know, there are guys that have come out of prison and become police department officers. And there have been guys that have come out of dark past and have come to the place where they became successes. There's nothing that says you can't do that. But we live in a day and an age where everybody wants to coddle everybody and say, well, you know, you if you'd have been there and you shouldn't have been there and you shouldn't. Listen, my mama told me where to go and where not to go and when to be home and what to say while I was there. And I was afraid. I was more afraid of mama than the police. You say, well, that's silly. Think of all the people you could have met. Yeah, I know. But I tell you, well, I like to think of all the people I have met because I did what mama said. I like to think about all the people I have gotten to know because mama told me to stay away from places I stayed away from. I'm thankful that when I met them, I could remember them because my mind wasn't torn up by drugs and alcohol and all the other junk. You say, well, you know, I know I'm probably just a terrible person, but I don't know what it is to be drunk. I've never touched a drop of alcohol in my life unless it was in a medicine bottle and the doctor didn't tell me about it. You say, well, you can't have any fun if you don't drink. I guess that's why I've been so bored my whole life. Just bored to tears. You know what? I spoke to our young people the other day, and I just enjoyed telling them, God makes your dreams come true when you follow Him and live for Him. And the problem with being a teenager is you don't know what your dreams really are. You're too young to have dreams. You're still an airhead. I mean that in a kind way. I'll tell you what you'll find out as you move along. God will change your dreams and the desires of your heart and then give them every one to you just as they come along. This is a place where when she comes home, she brings that bad name, that bad reputation. She's a failure. She made a foolish decision. She allowed this to happen. You know, all the things that could be said are all true of Naomi. We didn't go, and we did just fine. We stayed here, and our family's still alive. We didn't go that way. And look at that. My kids have grown. All of the things that she'd been warned about came to pass. And when she returns, she's a type of backslidden Israel. Verse number 3 and 4, he said to the kinsman, Naomi has come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land which was our brother Elimelech's. I thought to advertise it to thee. Skip down to the end of that verse. He said, I will redeem it. I want to buy it. And verse 5, then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth. Underline it, the Moabitess. The wife of the dead to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. Notice the kinsman changes his tune. I can't redeem it for myself. Why? Deuteronomy 25 verse 5 says, if brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and shall take her to him to wife to perform the duty of an husband's brother to her. You say this is the way it was done. Why? Because that land stayed in the family forever. And if he had no seed, he had to have children to pass that land to. And that's the way that it worked. It shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name not be not put out of Israel. You say, well, I know we don't do things like that today, and I'm not saying we should. I'm just saying that's the way that they did it. And notice in verse number 9 of Deuteronomy 25, when this thing takes place, then shall his brother's wife come to him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face. That was the way the contract was formed. I know you think that's stupid, but you get out an ink pen and sign the piece of paper and it'll work just fine. That's contract law. And under contract law, the legitimacy of Israel as God's people was to be preserved, and that land was to be passed from family, from father to son to child, all of them all the way down. And even if someone died and left no heirs, that could be accommodated. But that whole idea was in that. And that land, when it was sold, and it could be sold for a time frame. I'm just write down Leviticus 25:10 for the sake of time. But in Leviticus 25, verse number 10, as God's imposing these laws of care for their possessions, he put together the Jubilee. And the Jubilee occurred every 50 years in the nation of Israel. from the time it was established. Meaning what? Meaning if you took your property, and because you were impoverished for some reason or another, maybe you were incapacitated, maybe you got ill, maybe something along that line like Naomi, your husband was dead. They had a right to sell that property, but only could it be sold until the year of the Jubilee. And at the year of the Jubilee, every 50 years, everything went back the way it was. That's why the Civil War song said the Jubilee's coming. It's going to go back to the way it's supposed to be. And so that year of Jubilee would come, which meant that the longer you owned your home, the less value it could bring if you sold it. Because the guy that bought it from you could only own it for the remainder of that 50 years. Because at the end of that 50 years, it went back to its original family ownership every single time. So you're following along with that now. That's why their economy was a little different than ours. But that whole idea there was that that land was important enough. Those houses and homes and possessions were important enough that if an heir died without leaving an inheritance to someone that he could leave it to, then it was a job for someone to provide, make sure there was an heir to receive that parcel of ground so that it always remained in the house of Israel. Naomi is a type of backslidden Israel. She got out of the will of God. She went somewhere she wasn't supposed to do. She allowed things to go on in her own home, obviously fraternizing with Moabites. And then she comes home. She's a type of Israel that has given up on the things of God. So she represents that individual. Now, there's Boaz, and he's the fellow we're looking at here in this passage. The Bible tells us in Ruth chapter 2, verse number 1, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. Verse number 3 says, and she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and her hap was to light on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech. So we find out as we move into the book of Ruth that she does have kinsmen here. She has come home without seed. She has come home without any heirs. And there are some kinsmen. Verse number 19, her mother-in-law said unto her, where hast thou gleaned today after she's gone out to glean? And where wroughtest thou? Blessed be he that did take knowledge of thee. And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought and said, the man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz. And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead. You know what that's a reference to? That's a reference to that land perpetuation. What she said is, listen, how in the world are we going to find somebody to marry you? But you've found a near kinsman. She says at the end of that verse, the man is of near kin unto us. And so the story begins to unfold. Deuteronomy 23, I'll read you those verses here and we'll talk for just a moment. That passage says in Deuteronomy 23, an Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter to the congregation of the Lord, even to their 10th generation shall they not enter to the congregation of the Lord forever. Because they met you not with bread and with water by the way when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam the son of Beor of Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse thee. Nevertheless, the Lord thy God would not hearken unto Balaam, but the Lord thy God turned the curse into a blessing unto thee, because the Lord thy God loved thee. Thou shalt not seek their peace nor their prosperity all the days of thy life forever. How's that? Well, yeah, you know, God is love. I know, but the same passage is here. Okay, God wrote both of those. Meaning what? God is a God of love. But God's also a God of rules. God is also a God of principles and of values. And there are times when those values can be exceeded to a point where God said, never again. They used to refer in the old days of sinning away the day of grace. I don't believe in that theology. But I do believe this. You only say no to God so many times. I believe you can only postpone things with God so many times. And I honestly believe that it's not God punishing us. It's God saying, okay, have it your way. Have it your way. I believe young people, one of the greatest mistakes you'd ever make would be to say, God, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go here. I don't want to be that kind of person. I want to do my own thing. And the Lord will deal with you, and He will deal with you, and He will deal with you. But I could name at least 40 people I've known in my ministry. I believe with all of my heart, God said, okay, you got it. And they got to live their life. And the dream turned into a nightmare. And some of them took their own life at the end of it. Such a wonderful way to go. I think God puts down laws and imposes Himself in our lives and says, here's the way, walk ye in it. Oh, I believe that was out of the Bible, if I'm not mistaken. I think God says that to people. I think He says this to families. I think He says it to nations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord and the people whom He hath chosen for His inheritance. I think God blesses nations, and I think God curses nations. I think we walk every day on that pathway that says, walk this way, do this, be this kind of person. And if you do, I'll fulfill it. I'll fulfill every dream. I'll be abundantly gracious. I think that the Christian life is still, by far and away, the best life in the world. But I think you can make a choice, and at some point God says, my spirit will not always strive. You got it. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get right with the Lord when you've done wrong. That doesn't mean that you're condemned or damned in that sense. That doesn't mean you can't get saved. That just means at some point in time, things don't come back the way they were. They don't come back the way they were. I knew a fellow my mom witnessed 2 years ago down in Florida for days and days and days. And he'd sit and cry and he'd weep, and he got saved, but he wanted to live his own life and he wanted to do it his own way. And he just time and time again would call crying, and he would say, well, I know I should, and I know it's what, but I just, you got to understand. And then he became a quadriplegic because he was doing his own thing. And for the rest of his life, he never did his own thing again. But he cried every time my mom walked in the room. You say, why? God's not a cruel God. God's not saying, if you don't do what I want you to do, then I'm going to get you. God's saying, if you don't do what I'm telling you, you're going to go off that cliff and nobody can stop you. So when you go off the cliff, don't blame God. God tried to stop you. People ruin their homes, they ruin their jobs, they ruin their lives because God said, here's the way, walk in it. No, I'll do this. No, don't do that. And then you hit the wall. Don't ruin your life. Ruth is a type of an unworthy Gentile bride. She had everything against her. So much so that even her near kinsmen wouldn't claim her inheritance because it would defile his name. I don't suppose anybody here is related to Charles Manson. I would say if you were, you probably wouldn't tell anybody about it. Because, well, I'm not saying you were part of the crowd or part of the group or part of his crimes or murders, but you wouldn't want to be associated with him. And somewhere along the way, Ruth is that type of person. She's from the wrong place, from the wrong people, from the sins of those people. I mean, everything that is there, God said, that's the worst I've ever seen. I'm leaving them alone. Stay away from them. And now here she is in Israel. And here she is, the widow of a young man who was an Israelite, whose mom and dad did some stupid things and took them to the wrong place. And here's the mess. But Ruth, who's the unworthy Gentile, she's the outcast. She's the last thing that Jew would ever think of when he thought about being kind to somebody else. She is the bottom of the barrel. She's the offscouring of the earth. You say, why are you saying that? Because I think Scripture will bear me out at every single point. And yet, she says all the way back in that first chapter to Naomi, you've got something I don't have. And where you go, I'm going to go. And your people will be my people. And your God will be my God. Well, I got news for you, Ruth. Naomi's people are never going to be your people. That's forbidden. They're never going to be your people, not because of you, Ruth, but because of your people. Because of the atrocities of your people. It's never going to work out that way. You're going to struggle. But she returns, and when she gets there as an unworthy Gentile bride, she finds Boaz, who's a type of Christ. And Boaz finds something in her, and it doesn't matter anymore what her pedigree is. Doesn't matter what country she comes from. Doesn't matter where she is. All he sees is a young lady. He noticed several things about her. Her kindness. He noticed she was worked hard to provide for Naomi, her mother-in-law. He noticed all those characteristics. He did not just fall in love with her beauty. The Bible doesn't say she was beautiful. I'll tell you what he did know about her. He knew she was willing to take it. She was tough as nails. She was willing to make that journey from Moab all the way back to Israel, knowing what she was going to face. I'll tell you what else he knew. He knew she had a genuine love. If she was going to care for Naomi, who didn't deserve her to care for, if she didn't stay in her own homeland, he saw some characteristics in her that evidenced to him that she was everything he wanted in life. And somewhere along the way, that kinsman redeemer said, nobody wants her. Israel doesn't want her. They want to get rid of her. I'll take her. You understand all the bad that she represented and all the bad that her pedigree represented was the day she said, I do, was hidden in the grandeur and the greatness of Boaz. Boaz, the kinsman redeemer, the well-respected man, the landowner, the kind individual, the gracious individual that allowed others to reap harvest out of his own fields. That man who was the greatest of the Israelites as a type of Christ looked down on a poor handmaid that was just a loser by every place you'd want to investigate. And he said, I find something in her. And he chose her to be his bride. Let me help you with that. You and I are much more like this young lady by the name of Ruth. Unworthy. Defiled. Filthy. You say, well, I'm doing my best. Yeah, but you've done your worst too. And that doesn't go away. Aren't you glad there's a God in heaven that cares enough to overlook our faults, our sins, our crimes, and bestow upon us what we could never gain for ourselves? And that is by giving us His name. So he weds this young lady. The poem I found was this, an old poem. Doesn't rhyme necessarily the way maybe they should, but it was written several hundred years ago. And it says, Ruth was not rich, but lived upon alms, not honorable, but a poor stranger. She never said she was beautiful. If ever she had been so, we may suppose that weeping and traveling and gleaning had withered her lilies and roses. But that which made Boaz in love with her and solicitous to expedite the affair was that all her neighbors agreed she was a virtuous woman. This set her price with him far above rubies. And therefore he thinks if by marrying her he might do her a real kindness, he should also do to himself a very great kindness. So what is he saying? She didn't have anything to offer. But he thought by marrying her, he might do her a great kindness. But more than that, that's not love, that's pity. And the Bible tells us he loved her. By marrying her, he would be doing her a great service. He would be opening the doors that had been forever closed to her. He would be reestablishing her respectability. And one might say, well, that's what he was doing, but not so. He knew that she would likewise do more for him because he loved her than he could ever do for her. Isn't that true of the Lord Jesus Christ when he came? I'm glad to tell you he loved us and was willing to save us, and we are unworthy. But I think that's not just out of pity. I think he loves us because we add something to who he is and what he is by being a child of the King. So this is a great love story. It doesn't end there. It goes on down to a little fellow by the name of Obed. A little boy by the name of Obed. Obed means a slave. Obed means a slave, a servant. You say, why in the world would you name your child that?
Well, I don't know. You'd have to ask Ruth and her husband, but they named him that. You say, well, what does that mean? Well, if Ruth is the type of the undeserving, unworthy, outlander, and if Boaz is a type of Christ, then the sinner comes to Christ, and Christ gives them seed. Christ gives them a purpose in life. Christ gives them joy in life. And Obed, I believe, is a type of the church. He was begotten of the kinsman redeemer and the lowest of the unworthies. And because they were united, there comes the likes of Obed. Israel had forsaken the land of promise and became a partaker to the idolatrous Moabites. Their crimes were so great that God forbade any interaction forever with the Moabites. And yet, somehow, returning to the former estate, where there is no more inheritance remaining for her to receive, as a person who could never be loved and who would always be hated, she comes and she stays and she finds one that would care for her like none other ever would. And he changes her entire estate forever. When we talk about Ruth, we generally don't think, oh, horrible. Oh. When we talk about Ruth in the Old Testament, we talk about one of the kindest, the gentlest, and greatest of people. Why? Because of the way she conducted her life. And by the way, interestingly enough, you don't have to turn there tonight, but if you were to turn over to Matthew chapter 1 and come down through there, there's a genealogy given. It is the genealogy of Jesus Christ. And in that genealogy of Jesus Christ, you'll find that young Moabitess girl becomes part of the family of Jesus Christ himself in his earthly walk on this planet. I'm glad to tell you that the Lord didn't reject her. The Lord didn't say, whoa, nothing doing here. He comes to that. By the way, in that genealogy in the book of Matthew, there's no less than three harlots and Ruth the Moabitess. I'm glad that the Lord's not a respecter of persons, and he'll forgive anybody and save anybody. And treat. He's got some dudes in there that were murderers. There's all kind of things. The Lord's pedigree, to be honest with you, is probably as dubious as a lot of ours. And yet you say, why would he do that? Well, number one, because there is no such thing as perfection. And number two, because he wanted you to know no matter what your lot in life or how far you've gone or how bad you've been, he understands and he cares and he can change your life. The book of Ruth is the story of romance, the story of redemption. It is the story of someone who was unworthy of anything, getting everything. It is the story of an outcast being brought back to respectability. It is the story of someone who for the rest of their lives, I believe, woke up and looked in the mirror every morning and said, I don't deserve to be here, but here I am. I don't know how I got here. I was starving to death back in the land of Moab. By all rights, I should have died back in the land of Moab and no one would have ever known my name. And yet here we are 5,000 years into the future. And we all know her quite well. And what a lovely person she is. That's only what God can do. Because I remind you, there were thousands of people walking on planet Earth at the time of Ruth. We don't know who they are. We don't even know the name of her near kinsman that said, I can't buy her land. We don't know his name. And yet Ruth is a kind. People name their kids after Ruth. Why? You could name her Lizzie Borden, too, but you probably wouldn't. We have no problem naming our children Ruth because it became the greatest example of respectability and love that we know out of our Old Testament. But it was because of grace and truth that brought it to bear. All right, let's stand tonight, be dismissed.